In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go before us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me."
So here we have this passage. What a contrast. Did you see the very first verse? In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. So Uzziah was a king that was a good king at first. He followed after God, but then he got proud. And by the end of his life, God struck him with leprosy because he offered sacrifices in the temple that were unlawful. They were supposed to be only sacrifices that the priests were supposed to offer. But he went in there and did that. And the priests confronted him. And he pushed back, and God struck him with leprosy, and he died. In fact, at that point, the nation of Judah was in great decline. And this was the time that Isaiah was called as a prophet. And he gives this great thing. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. Who's the real king? The contrast? Uzziah is almost an afterthought. So he may have thought he was important, but ultimately he died and he wasn't important at all, which is the case for every human being that has ever lived. People want to be important. I want to be important. But there's this thing that called death that nobody escapes, and people forget. I knew my dad well. My kids knew him till they were young, but they knew him. My grandkids don't know him at all, know nothing about him. This is what it is for us. And yet we have the Lord seated on the throne who never, never, never dies. So the point here is that the Lord is the real king. That's an important backdrop for what we're going to consider today. Because our passage today is this picture of God on the throne. It's a picture of his glory shining so brightly that nothing can contain it. There are a few passages in the Bible that are this pronounced about who God is and the glory that emanates from him. So I want to talk about glory today, and I want us to look at three things. First of all, what it is, and this is where I'm in trouble, because how can I talk about, let you know what God's glory is, when it isn't even contained in the universe, right? So we're in trouble with that. I'm going to falteringly describe what I think God's glory is from the passage. Number two, what it does, and number three, what it gives. So those are the three: what it is, what it does, and what it gives. So let's look at what it is. Isaiah's having a vision. We know it's a vision because God is a spirit, and no one can see a spirit. No one can see a spirit with human eyes. In addition to that, it says no one can see God and live. So he's not actually seeing God. He's seeing him in a vision. It's a vision that he has of God in the temple. He's on a throne. Well, I don't think God actually sits on a throne. How can a throne contain him when the whole universe can't contain him? So it's imagery that that talks about his ruling and his reigning. It's about authority and control over his creation. So what is it that Isaiah sees? Well, he sees God's glory. That's what it says. Well, it says here that the train of his robe filled the temple in verse 1. So even though the word for glory is not given until verse 3, all of this is actually about God's glory. The Hebrew word for glory is kavod, and it means weight, worth, wealth, splendor, dignity. His glory is so big, it is so strong that the temple cannot contain it, and neither can the whole earth. It tells us that the train of his robe, which is his clothing, fills the temple with glory. The clothing, it's so large and so flowing that it fills the entire temple. So what about God's glory? Theologians would say, and Bible scholars would say, that God's goal for the earth is that his glory be seen and revered by all. That his glory be seen and revered by all. In other words, his goal is his glory. That brings up all kinds of red flags for secular people. They don't like that. What kind of an egotist is all about his own glory? I've heard people say that. What kind of an egotist is about his own glory? And then I've heard a few expletives with that. I think it's a fair question. When we see politicians who are arrogant, we don't like it. Imagine a politician who would say, I'm here to give my glory to the entire country. Would he get elected or she? Nope, probably not. We don't like that. So is it egotistical for God to want his glory to shine and for all of us to recognize his glory and to see his glory? Or is there something else going on here? So I want to cover two things. So, by the way, this is like the three bears, where the one chair was too hard and the one was too soft and the other one was just right. So the first point is too long, the second point is way short, and the third point is medium, okay? So just bear with me for now, okay? Good analogy. That's the only thing you're going to remember about the sermon. He talked about the three bears. All right. Two things I want you to remember here about his glory. It tells us that there are seraphim around the throne, and they're calling out to one another. This is verse 2. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. So what does it mean to be holy? Edward Young, in his commentary, says this, and I have it up here for you because I want you to read with me if it comes. There we go. Oh, that's small. Can you see that? Okay. Holy signifies the entirety of the divine perfection which separates God from his creation, okay? He's wholly other than we are. God is the creator who exists in absolute independence of the creature. He is the Lord and not a man. Although the creation depends upon him, he himself is entirely independent thereof. Okay, he is the divine perfection which separates God from his creation. Totally separate. This is the transcendence we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Transcendence and immanence. God is above his creation, and as such, In the words of theologian John Frame, he exercises authority and control. He actually expands the transcendence idea. Remember, transcendence is that he's wholly other. He's beyond us. That we are here, he is there, independent of his creation. But he exercises authority and control over his creation. But notice how really intense this is. So these seraphim that are above him, and they're not above him, obviously, in rank. They're just flying, and they're calling out to one another. They're simply flying around the throne, and the essence of the seraphim is brightness. So the word actually means fire. They're like balls of fire that are flying around the throne, and they are so bright because they are pure and good. There is no evil found in them whatsoever. They have no evil, and it says that they have six wings. With two wings, they cover their feet. It's a sign of humility, a sign of humility to cover their feet. With two wings, they fly, and then notice this one. But with two wings, they cover their faces. They cover their faces. Why? Because not even they, pure beings, pure fire, not even they are allowed to look on the face of God. Can you imagine that? Compared to his brilliance, they are dull and they must cover their faces. But notice also what they cry. Holy, holy, holy. See, this is significant because in Hebrew culture, I'm sure many of you have heard this, but maybe you haven't. In Hebrew culture, whenever anything gets repeated, it's to emphasize what you are saying. Jesus would often say, "Truly, truly, I say to you." It wasn't that he was trying to get their attention. What he was saying is, what I'm saying now is really important. I'm emphasizing, "Truly, truly, I'm saying this to you. Now listen up." So now imagine that it's not just repeated once, it's repeated twice. So it's three times that it says, holy, holy, holy. It's for supreme, supreme emphasis. Nowhere else in the Bible is there something repeated three times. Only about his holiness is it repeated three times. So Isaiah is giving testimony to what he saw, and it was so glorious. It was so glorious that he wrote it down. God is three times holy, not because he's so self-absorbed or he's some kind of an egotist, but it's just simply because it's true. He's unlike any other being. He's independent from his creation and needs none of it to be. He needs none of it because he is the great one. But there's something else here in verse 3. It says the whole earth is full of his glory. Edward Young says that the glory of God is the revelation of his attributes. It's the revelation of his attributes. So the idea here is that there's so much glory that it overwhelms the earth. Everything that has been created is a manifestation of his glory. That's why Psalm 19:1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The sky above proclaims his handiwork." It's not the only thing that shows his glory, but it is a major thing that we can see. The creation around us shows his glory. It's not just the heavens, it's the creation, the whole creation, including earth and beyond. And so what was the reason that he created the world? If we think he's so far removed from us, or he has some kind of an ego that needs to be satisfied by people seeing and worshiping his glory, why would he create the world? He didn't have to create the world. He doesn't need the world. He doesn't need anything about it. In fact, we have here an inkling of the Trinity. It says in verse 8, "Who will go for us?" The Trinity talking. See, God is one God in three persons, and among the persons of the Godhead, there's perfect joy, perfect love, perfect relationship, perfect everything. They don't need anything. God does not need his creation. So he creates the world because he wants to share his joy with the people that he would create in his own image. Ah, that's a far different God than the one who might be called an egotist. This is the God who thinks of others, creates a human race to share in his joy. The Christian philosopher Dallas Willard wrote that God is the most joyous being in the universe. And he illustrated it with this following story. This is what he says. While I was teaching in South Africa some time ago, a young man took me out to see the beaches near his home in Port Elizabeth. I was totally unprepared for the experience. I had seen beaches, or so I thought, but when we came over the rise where the sea and land opened up to us, I stood in stunned silence and then slowly walked towards the waves. Words cannot capture the view that confronted me. I realized that God sees this all the time. He sees it, experiences it, knows it from every possible point of view. This and billions of other scenes like it and unlike it, in this and billions of other worlds, great tidal waves of joy must constantly wash through his being. We pay a lot of money to get a tank with a few tropical fish in it and never tire of looking at their beauty and marvelous forms and movements. But God has seas full of them, which he constantly enjoys. We are enraptured by a well-done movie sequence or by a few bars from an opera or lines from a poem. We treasure our great experiences for a lifetime, and we may have very few of them, but he is simply one great, inexhaustible, and eternal experience of all that is good and true and beautiful and right. And then he concludes this way, all of the good and beautiful things from which we occasionally drink tiny droplets of soul-exhilarating joy, God continuously experiences in all their breadth and depth and richness. If that's true, I want to be with him. I want some more glory. If he's the essence of joy and he enjoys his creation, which means he enjoys us. See, the fact that his goal is his glory is something that we should stand up and clap about. It should make us dance. He wants to share his glory with us. No wonder the thresholds, the foundations of the threshold shook in verse 4. His glory is overpowering. He's three times holy, the God that lives far above us. He lives in unapproachable light, as Paul says, but he is also the God of beauty that our souls long for. That's point number one. Number two, what it does. So Isaiah's reaction, perhaps it's unexpected, perhaps it's not, in verse 5, and he said, woe is me. That was his reaction. I'm in trouble. I'm in deep weeds. I'm done. Why? Well, because such brightness shines on all of his imperfections. It shines right into his imperfections. So God made this world and put Adam and Eve in the world, but instead of bowing before his glory, they decided they wanted their own glory. And that's been the issue ever since. God's glory, our glory. We have sought after our glory so often. Ray Ortland, in his commentary on Isaiah, says this, and this is another one, nothing is just ordinary. The whole earth is full of his glory. We keep trying to fill it with monuments to our own glory, kingdoms, businesses, hit songs, athletic victories, and other mechanisms of self-salvation. But it's like trying to compare King Uzziah's glory with the true glory of the living God. It's the difference between the sun and a deep, dark cave. If even the perfect fireballs known as the seraphim, who are pure, if they have to cover their faces and they have never stopped glorifying God, they have always glorified God, they have done it perfectly, if even they have to cover their faces, what does it say about us? Woe is me. God exposes sin. He shines the light on everything you think, everything you do, every single motive you have. And when Isaiah sees the glory, he cries, woe. But he continues his reasoning in verse 5, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So some people say that he's talking about unclean lips because he's a prophet, and there's probably more than one meaning. He needed cleansing because this is how he earned his living or whatever he spoke. But I think more likely here it's a comparison with the purity of the seraphim, her declaring holy, 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 and what he can declare. He has no purity in him whatsoever, and he can't declare anything. They do it in a pure way. He doesn't, and he recognizes that. See, to stand naked before a holy God on your own is to be destroyed. There's no hope for the one that thinks he will stand before God on their own merits. It's not possible. Point number three, what it gives. Verses 6 and 7, then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for. So the amazing thing about God is that he wants to share his glory, and he provides a way. It's not as if some coal of an altar was enough to forgive Isaiah's sin. That's not the point. Remember, this is a vision. It's a symbol of forgiveness. It's a symbol of forgiveness. It comes from the altar and it represents a sacrifice. On that altar, blood was shed. This is the entire Old Testament sacrificial system. On that altar, blood was shed. Hebrews 9:22 tells us about it. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. For forgiveness to happen, there needs to be bloodshed. Someone has to pay the price. I have a close friend that I was talking to not too long ago. He's a clergyman. And he doesn't believe that Jesus' death was somehow to atone for sins, but that God can handle it. He can handle our sins. Jesus only died to empathize with us in our struggles. But what he has done is to gut this entire passage of the glory and the holiness of God, that when it shines on unholy people, you can only say, woe is me. Woe is me. It needs bloodshed. Somebody's got to pay. And this is where the gospel comes in. The God, the one that lives in unapproachable light, the most joyous being in the universe, the three times Holy One, takes the initiative to come and atone for our sins. Jesus Christ became the sacrifice. He left his throne of glory. He left his existence of pure, total, unabashed joy to humble himself. And then he became subjected to a criminal's death. And he comes down and he touches our lips, as it were, with the coal. But the price of forgiveness was that the coals on the altar burned him up. To keep going with the analogy, he was the sacrificial lamb so that we could be forgiven. But it's much more than just forgiveness, you know. It's not that he just wipes the slate clean. It's that he also gives us his righteousness. He gives us his own righteousness so that everything changes and we are declared righteous, not with a righteousness of our own, but because Jesus' righteousness is credited to our account. Justice has been served. We are no longer counted as sinners. There is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. When God the Father says they have sinned, Jesus stands and says, I demand justice because I have accomplished the justice for sin. So what are the implications from the passage? See, the seraphim had to cover their faces, even though they were pure, right? But for those who cling to Jesus, that is all gone. We can face him without any covering. Look at what it says in 2 Corinthians. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Can you imagine? We enter boldly into the throne room because we are clean, because We can come in without the veil, without covering our faces. Those who by faith trust in Jesus are declared clean. This is what theologians call justification. It's not that we're made righteous, we're declared righteous. Let's not get these things confused. Justification is a declaration that you are righteous. It doesn't mean you're righteous right away. The righteousness comes, that's in the process of sanctification. It's not our righteousness. It's not some kind of an infusion of righteousness that somehow now we are the righteous ones. It's that his righteousness covers us. His righteousness covers us. Does this mean we don't sin anymore? Absolutely not. What it means is that now by faith we trust him to make us what we've been declared to be. We lean into our justification. We fight against our sin because it's not who we are. Our sin is the attempt to make something man-made into something glorious. Our sin is our trying to get our own glory, and it's sinister, and it's sneaky, and it's subtle. But it doesn't hold a candle to the glorious love that draws us home. So as we live our Christian lives, we cling harder and harder to Jesus, and he begins to transform us and to give us power to be who we have been declared to be. How absurd would it be to try to find our own glory? That makes no sense. I close with this. Ray Ortlund says this: created reality is a continuous explosion of the glory of God. And history is the drama of his grace, awakening in us dead sinners eyes to see and taste, to enjoy and courage to obey. Do you realize that it is God's will to make this earth into an extension of his throne room in heaven? Do you realize that it is God's will for his kingdom of glory to come into your life and for his will to be done in you as it is done in heaven? Heaven is expanding, spreading in your direction. That is the meaning of your existence. If you will accept it and enter in, heaven is taking over. Yield. Yield. O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths, its flow may richer, fuller be. O joy that seekest me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be. And the last one, O cross that liftest up my head, I dare not ask to fly from thee. I lay in dust, life's glory dead, and from the ground there blossoms red, life that shall endless be. See, when he calls us, when we see his glory, when we see his forgiveness, then we can say with Isaiah, here am I, send me. That's the gospel, brothers and sisters, and it changes everything. Let's pray.